This is a special episode because unlike the interviews I do online and unlike my solo tutorials, I get a chance to stand in the same room with my friend Jess Rufus.
In the flesh.
In the flesh.
I know. We don't live that far from each other.
We don't. And it's one of those days where Jess is launching something. And we thought, why don't we just chat about it? Because people need to do more about partnerships.
Yeah.
And they're not. And if they are, they're not doing it great.
There's just ways they can optimize it to get better results.
So true. So if nobody knows who you are, Jess, if they've been living under a rock.
We don't have enough time to go into all of that.
Oh, well, give me the truncated backstory of Jess, because I know it pretty well.
Yeah.
But you've been doing this collaboration partnership driven stuff for a long time.
Yeah, I have been. I don't want to show my age too much, but I started out in fashion PR. So I was a publicist originally. And then I went and worked in small business marketing education, where I showed a lot of small businesses how to DIY their own marketing, and partnerships was part of that. And Tinder was becoming really popular at the time. And I thought, oh my gosh, how good would it be to have some sort of like Tinder for business where you could swipe right on brand partnerships, which is how Collabosaurus came about. And that was basically a Tinder for business. So I built a software company in 2014. And
does that not feel like a long time ago now?
Oh, yeah. Like a long time. Well, it is a long time ago.
It's dog years and normal work years, right? There's a lot going on in those years.
Yeah. So Collabosaurus, I grew that and scaled it to about 11,000 brands. So we worked with Walmart and Pinterest and Estee Lauder and Marks and Spencer, a whole heap of brands, and basically match made them for clever collabs and partnerships. But they were predominantly unpaid partnerships. So it was marketing collabs like social media giveaways or event collabs and things like that. And then I sold that business about 18 months ago, and now I'm in toilets. So it's really like, it's a weird story. So I went from tech to toilets. I now run a toilet fragrance brand that's very bougie called Number Two. And I still do a little bit of consulting and stuff, and partnerships is still one of my favorite topics in the world. Partnerships has allowed me to sell out my product business, like Number Two, four times over. So collabs for the win every time.
So being in the toilet, not so bad.
It's not so bad. It's a bougie toilet.
It's a
Yeah.
That's awesome. So you also do a lot of education. So you have a podcast as well where people can tune in, Marketing ATM it's called. You should really get after that. I really enjoy every episode.
Thank you.
There is a lot to be taught. And I think when we go back and look at all of the different ways that we used to do business back in the 2000s, back in the 20-teens, there was a bunch of stuff you could use from a marketing and outreach point of view. And your comment when we last caught up really stayed with me, which was a lot of the stuff that we used to use to grow is no longer really as effective as it used to be. Mm-hmm. And so now we have to sort of build in public in order to learn because things are changing so quickly. And so tell me a bit about why you think that's the case in your Number Two world in particular, because there is so many brands, there's just so much coming at us all the time. Trying to break through is pretty tricky, but still partnerships seem to make brands still, even through all of that frenetic social stuff that's coming at us all the time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's funny because I think so many platforms and like their effectiveness definitely shifts and changes over the years. You know, just look at Facebook.
Yep.
And people who got started organically on Facebook went absolutely nuts, like Shopo back in the early 2000s. And then that has shifted and changed, and now TikTok's the thing, and it just changes all the time. But I do think that at its core, you know, marketing basic principles don't change. And at the end of the day, it's just about, you know, that customer journey path of building that trust with the customer so that they make a purchasing decision. And partnerships are a fast track to trust because you can align with a brand that has already established that trust with their audience. And then it's a win-win partnership. It's only a partnership if it's win-win. It can't be win-lose. But if you can really align yourself, that helps you establish credibility. It helps you establish trust, and it can help you convert customers faster as well. I mean,
totally.
In my software business, we partnered with Microsoft, and that was a huge deal. Microsoft was so much bigger than Collabosaurus. Like, they were huge. And that bit, like, there's different benefits that come with different types of partnerships, of course, you know this absolutely, but the Microsoft partnership for me, it was beneficial because of the credibility piece and because of the trust piece.
Mm-hmm.
That established our kind of awareness and immediate trust within a business community, which was just so, so valuable.
Yeah. And we could talk about all the reasons why it goes wrong.
Sure.
Right? For days, we could talk about that. But I think we've both agreed that there is really small things that people can do to actually make it not fail.
Yeah.
And you teach this, I teach this, in different sort of ways we do this. And I think the thing that always strikes me is it doesn't work. It's never worked. Or we tried it once and it's not working. And you and I have seen all the reasons why that's the case. Mm. Let's touch on those just for a minute, because they're the objections that we hear every day. Yet we've still built companies, we've still formed relationships, we've still done things which people go, how did you do that? And we go, no, we're still doing the partnership thing. This is not anything different.
Mm.
From my world in healthcare and biotech and defense and aerospace, they're just bigger, more complicated beasts often because there's more people involved. Not because the technology's super tricky, it's just because there's different people involved. What do you see that people keep on getting wrong, just sort of stumbling over, and maybe in their own minds because they're still, they hear it's a good idea, they're thinking, yeah, we should be doing more partnerships. I get that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Where are they falling down in what you see?
Gosh, there's so many reasons why a partnership might fall flat or not be feeling like it's working for a business. But as you said, they're pretty simple things to fix, which is great. I think a lot of business owners and marketing managers that I speak to get stuck on the idea and they're like, I don't have a big creative idea as to how I can like make this really amazing. And then, or they really have a narrow focus on one brand that they really want to partner with.
Yep.
And that's great. But actually you can see so much value from collaborating and partnering up with other brands regularly throughout the year. It's not just a once in a blue moon type partnership always. Like, you know, the one that I did with Microsoft, for example, was a little bit of a once in a blue moon big partnership. But I also did, you know, 10 plus partnerships throughout the year to help me reach new customers and build revenue. So I think getting stuck on the idea is actually people focusing on the wrong problem rather than looking at what marketing outcome do they actually want to get out of a partnership? And then from there, looking at which brand partners could actually help me achieve that goal. And then how can you add value to those brand partners and kind of going from there rather than having this, you know, getting stuck on this unique, really creative idea, which is actually going to shift and change depending on who you will be pitching a partnership to, because it depends on the partner's goals and the partner's asset set.
That's it. That's it. I wonder, you know, I've seen your Instagram feed often has inspiration for collaborations that you sort of go, oh, yeah, I never thought of that as an idea. And there are some wild and crazy ideas out there, which I think are amazing because what every brand is trying to get to is relevance and maintain relevance. And I figure that, you know, somebody put to me the other day, what about something like IKEA and Airbnb? I just had to think about that for a minute. That was like the craziest one I've heard in the last few months, which was also like what Reid Hoffman said about Airbnb when he didn't invest first time round.
Mm-hmm.
I think he said something like, who the hell is going to stay in your next bedroom to rent it from you? That's just got risk all over it.
Yeah. Love the Airbnb story.
Yeah, so me good. Too, right? Yeah. You sort of go, so the crazy ideas can be really interesting when people realize that that relevance play is such a critical play for every brand under any circumstance, even now when the world is shifting as hard as it is.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your favorite, I'd love to see, but I haven't seen them yet,
ooh,
collaboration ideas? And you go first and I'll go, because I've got a couple of right out there ones, but I think it's just, I don't know, I'm curious.
That's such a good question. And, you know, I don't get asked that a lot. I actually, I've just recently done a content series on, you know, if I worked for X brand, here are the collabs I would do. I think I was just doing that for Louis Body, which is a like giftable razor brand for women. And I think there's a lot they can do that's just really creative. My head goes to the real life collab with Shani Nicholas and Spotify. Did you see that one?
I did, yeah.
So for anyone who doesn't know that one, it's basically playlists based on your star sign, which is really clever. And people loved that because it felt really personalized. Mm-hmm. And I think Louis Body could do something similar because Fun Day Sweets. Fun Day Sweets is the brand I'm thinking of. Fun Day Sweets has like no sugar added lollies.
Yep.
And so if they partnered up with like a Chris Corsini or like Astro Twins and did psychic readings where there's only good news, like there's no bad stuff and no nasties, I think that would be really fun.
Interesting.
But yeah, there's so many things you could do. Like if you give me a brand, I could probably think of a creative random partner.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll get you.
What about you? I want to hear yours.
Okay. So, I love the idea of two brands that you would never pair together. And that Airbnb and IKEA one stuck with me because it was like, why am I going to, as a consumer, why would that appeal? And as Airbnb lovers, as a family, when we travel and we go to places, we never stay in hotels. It's always an Airbnb somewhere else. And for the most part, our daughters will come out of that and just sort of go, I love that part of that bedroom. Can I go and find that for the bedroom? Of course, the next place we go to is IKEA. Mm-hmm. And so then we find ourselves wandering through that ridiculously stressful maze of places trying to find that one piece of the thing that was there. And we don't do it often, but when we do, it's kind of interesting. And the question became, well, could you spend a night in IKEA experiencing a whole bunch of different things so you could walk away with whatever the sale was? And it was like, maybe. Maybe that could work. Like, I don't want to think about the logistics in the back end of that, but that would just be something that I think could be interesting for people to go, that is a very unique and novel play.
Yeah.
Also, hinging on Airbnb, the idea about how they took the Bluey franchise and turned that into something that is so fundamentally Australian, which is now, I was on a podcast the other day with someone from the PGA who's got a young daughter, age three, and he, as a Florida man through and through, spends the majority of his non-work time watching Bluey with his daughter. And he recited back to me all these things that we take for granted. But this brand has become so large that the ability for other brands to hinge off the back of it has become monstrous.
Yeah.
Now, these are all interesting things to catch people's attention. But I also go into things like the unsexy things that don't get seen very often. When I think about supply chains, and particularly during COVID, while I was running a healthcare brand, and it became really clear where all the things come from. And you don't really realize where they all come from. Like we had things coming from Malaysia. We had these things coming out of Japan. We had some technology come out of the US. And they all ultimately arrive in a port and you get a package or packages. But you never think about how complicated it is when things start to break at the seams. I'm quite worried about what's happening around the world at the moment in terms of what that looks like. But for me, when you look at a brand that started like Atomo Diagnostics, they started with all these fantastic point of care tests. And all of a sudden it went into, we can do point of care COVID testing. And they had this other barrage of tests they could do as well. But they were able to pivot very quickly into something that was really needed. And people that were made to do that successfully made a fortune over that period. Now, will that come back again? Probably not. But they could move really, really quickly. And their supply chain offshore was able to move really quickly with them. And I don't think we pay enough attention to just how much it takes to have our shelves full for us to order things easily. It's a really fragile layer. And so when I think about the unsexy part of partnerships, which I actually really love, it's how does the machine work in the background to get things from point A to point B? We were looking at an opportunity around IV fluids. That's a bit geeky, but as a scientist, IV fluids, anytime that you go into hospital, if you're in surgery, IV fluids is a thing. If you've ever donated blood, you'll know that IV fluids play a big part. But we have a really big problem with that in Australia because we don't actually make a lot of it here. So we bring it, we're shipping these massive shipping containers full of these bags of fluid.
Yeah, right.
So that we can do stuff. And it's like, well, what happens if that doesn't work anymore? And we've got people in hospitals trying to recover or trying to do chemotherapy or whatever else. You just don't have the stuff.
Yeah.
And the question that somebody said to me was, well, I get the idea, the robotics and all the manufacture, we can do that, but how do we get it places? And this was a super random idea. I hadn't processed it well enough, but I put it on the table anyway. McDonald's. So the thing that fuels McDonald's is a massive logistics operation. It is fundamentally, it's not really a restaurant business. It's a real estate and logistics company. And the amount of trucks that we don't know, but they're just like Linfox trucks and things, traveling around. They are leaving from a hub with all the food and all the bits. They're dropping it off, and then they're empty going to other places. And the question became, well, maybe not just McDonald's, but other logistics brands. How could you make the use that downtime to get things to other places and make it just more efficient? So the truck or the transport companies make a lot more money. People get what they need. No one's out of pocket, but it's just better utility.
Yeah.
And people said, oh, and just people started scribbling it down. I thought, oh.
It's just an idea.
Yeah, that's right. It's one of those ideas. So it's just that kind of stuff where it's like, well, could we think more deeply about this? Because when I guarantee people listening to this they'll be driving on the road, listening to this, and sort of you'll see a truck go past. And the question you should ask is, how full is that truck?
Yeah.
And who else could be using it well? Just because you see a particular brand on it doesn't mean that it can't be used for something else. So that's sort of an idea.
I love that.
Sort of
things. Yeah. And I think that was the concept behind Sendal, wasn't it?
Correct.
That they raised millions and millions of dollars off that
idea.
But absolutely. I think when it comes to partnerships, it's just understanding, you know, yeah, you could build something entirely from scratch yourself and it would cost a whole lot of money. Or you can partner up with a business that's already done that thing.
That's it.
And you can tap into the value that they already have.
Now, we promised each other not to make this too salesy.
Yes, I didn't want to be too rational.
But there is a need. There are people that will say privately, I think we need help with this. And you've got something that they can help with that.
Jess? I do. So I've just launched Iconic Duos, which is
Tell us about that.
My partnerships course. And it's basically everything you need to build really cool, creative partnerships in your business. I mean, you have a course as well. I think they're both really complementary. We were talking about them and there's definitely overlap for sure, but I think it comes down to like which one would be suitable for certain brands comes down to the business size, the industry space, and the stage they're at with and experience level with partnerships.
Yep.
So Iconic Duos is fantastic if, particularly if you have an over-reliance on Facebook ads, I would say that's probably one of the biggest things. Facebook ads are driving a lot of growth for you, but there's definitely a problem with over-reliance there, and partnerships can really add a whole new revenue stream to your business or shake up the way you're reaching customers to convert them. Typically, it's fashion, beauty, lifestyle, food and beverage businesses, teams of one through to maybe 10 max. And it's a 9-module course that I take a live cohort through. So it's really great
fun.
Networking and brainstorming and stuff as well. So that's Iconic Duos.
That's awesome. There is something about the way that like-minded people trying to get to an objective when they're able to have free space and not and feel safe, I guess, to have those conversations in a live coaching environment is really, really fun. Mm. And it does take the load off because I find in our coaching sessions for the Partnership Lab, I will talk for a little bit and then the others will start bouncing off each other.
Yeah,
and there is something awesome about that.
Well, also just think about how many courses you've signed up to. It's like unless you have that live component, I mean, for me anyway, I need that accountability to actually get the coursework done.
That's it.
So, yeah, this one was really important to me to actually run a live cohort so that, you know, that accountability happens and also there's that support element there too.
Yeah, that's right. I think that I would recommend it because that point of relevance and that idea of, I guess when people come to partnerships are often thinking it'll be great to get notoriety and a halo effect. But when we think about the true underlying metrics of this, right, the dramatic drop in the cost to serve, the cost to acquire, the cost to retain, then the revenue that goes up at much higher margins. I've got a couple of questions for you around this. How do you think about a partnership duration? Like when you look at people going, we should do a deal, and the deal as soon as somebody says we should do a deal, I feel as though it goes into a very short time box campaign focused kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And every partnership I've ever been part of it needs time to breathe, because as soon as that pen ink is dry on the deal and the work begins, then discovery starts essentially, even though the intent might be well set up in the past. So how do you think about the timeline for somebody to go, like what's the optimal mindset people should have? Is it, am I looking for 6 months? Should I be going for like, look, if this works really well, we should try this year on year on year. And it might not be that there's campaigns every 2 minutes going out for that partnership, but surely there's got to be a good chunk of time for people to do that, right?
That's a really good question. I think a lot of businesses don't ask that question because they think about a partnership and it's like this, they have one in mind and they want to do a campaign around it. And then really, if it's with a large business, it might take a year, you know, to pull off. I usually like to look at partnerships from, I mean, starting with what you actually want to achieve off the back of a partnership and then doing a really nice balance between proactive and reactive, long-term and short-term partnerships. So the short-term ones can be campaign-based and they can be pulled together really quickly. Maybe it's like a content series collaboration, or maybe it's a bundle of your products together, or a limited edition packaging, or a limited edition scent, or something like that. And it can be campaign-based. And that's a really great way to test whether that partnership is going to be valuable to repeat in slightly different ways down the line. But then you also have the longer term ones that can be ongoing for years and years and years and continue to cross promote and bring you new customers and revenue streams and reach. So for example, for number two, even looking at my own business, we have a partnership with South Coast Experiences, who have a like fleet of beautiful, beautiful homes down the South Coast. And they put number two in all of the bathrooms. And I know it's a really great discovery point. All of the owners of those homes then have an access to like a discounted number two package. And that's a small partnership, but it's been in place for years and continues to drive customers and revenue, and also discovery for me, because everyone's staying in the beautiful houses find number two as well. So that's an example of a long-term partnership. And then we've done short-term partnerships where it's like, for example, around Mother's Day, you team up with a complimentary brand. We've just done Adorn Cosmetics and teamed up with them and done a giveaway together. So that was a short-term thing. And then looking at like Gelato Messina, who are kings of collaboration. Oh,
so good. And delicious.
And delicious.
Honestly.
They did a partnership with Lano Lips on a, it was like a gelato flavored lip gloss. And that, I think, started out as a campaign.
Yes.
I actually have it on my lips right now. It's amazing. That's why it's top of mind.
For the record, I don't. But my daughters, who are mecca, let's just call them mecca junkies, they are. They are across so much of this that they see it a mile away, and that's why we go there. It's not, I mean, the gelato is good, but we saw this and it was like, Dad, did you know about this? Really didn't.
Oh my gosh.
Please tell me all about it.
There's a pistachio praline gelato I'm newly obsessed with. And yeah, it's incredible.
Okay.
But the Lano Lips collab, I think it started off as one, and then that was so successful. It garnered so much press attention, so many sales, that then they've done it again and done another flavor together. Yep. So really, the successful partnerships, they're repeatable.
Yes.
You know, and once you kind of get used to what structures work for you, what types of partners work for you, what types of marketing campaigns and leverage you can use to make those partnerships work for you, once you know which ones of those work best, you can just repeat that formula again and again
with
different brands. And
I wonder, I wonder how people open these conversations with partnerships. The attention spans of people are going down. We've got multiple ways that we can be reached. I love it when I hear people say, I don't know how to reach that person. They go, really? How many options are there really? Like, there's so many options. But often it takes a long time, at least in my experience, for somebody to feel confident to write really fantastic outreach, to get the attention, to go, I think we can help you fill in the blank pain point to get started. Would you be open to a conversation? And I have an example where in one of my previous companies, we were at a real, we were in a really tricky spot when it came to one of our core products that relied on a very important scientific kit. And we had to make a decision. It was literally one of those fork in the road moments where it was like, super expensive, kind of out of our reach, it was going to break us, or we could go with the one that we knew but we had no way to negotiate as a small company. And I remember reaching out on LinkedIn to the CEO, who on his LinkedIn profile, to his credit, had a video that his team had put together saying why the company is so good, what we're here to do. And it didn't sound bullshittish to me. It sounded quite authentic. And I wrote him a connection request. It's something like, hi, I'll leave his name out. we're in the middle of making a decision on whether we go with your brand or this brand. I appreciate your counsel. Can we organize a time to chat? Now, ironically, he did not accept that LinkedIn request. 24 hours later, though, one of his senior VPs reached out, and then we had a meeting 2 days later. And that led to a fantastic outcome for a business. When somebody reaches out to you for help with this stuff, or when in your number with your number two hat on, what do you love to see for you to go, oh, there could be something there, without you having to overwork to try and work out if there was something there? Yes. Out.
Yeah.
Well, what are you looking for in that?
Oh my gosh. And can I just say that this has to be said with partnerships? I think anyone on the fence about, like, I don't know whether I want to learn about partnerships and it just seems like a lot of work or whatever. These skills are applicable to every aspect of your business.
Oh my
God. You want to raise capital for your business, these skills are necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just partnerships, it's everything.
Everything.
If you want to, like, be a better salesperson, you need to know this mm-hmm. stuff too. So I think really it's simple stuff, but a lot of people, we're not taught this at uni. No, I remember never being taught how to write an email, and
yep.
going into my first job was just like baptism by fire. It was yep. just like, oh, wow, this is how it all works.
That's it.
Oh, my goodness. But to answer your question, I think it just has to communicate value off the bat. Like, I have to see what could potentially be in it for me
mm-hmm.
before I give up a lot of my time. And I think where a lot of businesses go wrong in that first pitch email is that they make it too much about themselves or give way too much information up front. They're trying to marry them on the first date.
Yep.
They're not trying to get the first date. Really, the purpose of that email is securing enough interest to secure a first date, and then you can discuss more at length. So I think keeping it short and snappy and mm-hmm. focused on what could be potentially beneficial to the person that you're reaching out to is really important. I usually say to brands I work with, like, leave yourself almost out of it, out of that first email.
Mm.
You want to tease why it could be really beneficial to them.
That's it.
Get the first date.
Can everyone please just
go on dates.
Just please do that. I mean, and just recognize that if you can solve a problem for them, you'll be in the top 1% of people reaching out for them. So I remember writing a post that was all about what makes a 1% pitch a 1% pitch. And it's these kind of things, right? Just making it clear, simple, not about you, tight, super, super tight. And please don't use ChatGPT for this.
Oh, yeah, ChatGPT isn't quite there yet.
It's not quite there.
I think being able to help you with that. But, I mean, we were talking the other day about this, and I'm thinking about, I had a pitch the other day with a company that's 98 times larger than mine, thanks mm-hmm. to your introduction, actually. And it went really well because we could understand the value on both sides.
Yep.
And I could communicate that. I actually knew even though I'm tiny, I still have value that they'd yep. want to tap into.
Yes.
So I think, yeah, it's understanding how you can frame that and identify that. Or if you don't have that already, maybe there's a chance you can create value for yes. that partner, which is what I did with Microsoft in my last business. So I went into a pitch with Microsoft thinking, oh, they can sponsor my podcast. Really, mm. it was just a simple kind of paid advertising partnership structure. And then once we had a conversation, I said, what is it that you guys are really focused on at the moment? What are you working on? What are your marketing goals? And they said something I completely didn't expect, which is that they wanted to increase foot traffic to their Pitt Street store.
Right.
Which I never would have guessed, yep. you know, and I'm so glad I asked the question. And so I said, okay, let me go away and pull together some ideas. And in the end, we did a live podcast recording at the store, and I brought a bunch of business owners in. And so it hit their goal and it hit my goal.
And so on that sponsorship side, what is really important, I think, for people to realize is that you might need one objective met. For example, reach, brand halo effect, revenue, cost reductions, whatever the case is. But remember that most businesses have multiple touch points. So when we think about, at least here for my small practice, there's podcasts, there's LinkedIn, there's a whole range of things that we do very deliberately. And those touch points, if you just pitch in one sort of direction and you don't listen to what they're actually looking for, you've left all the value off the table. And that's a really sad thing because we've all got so many different ways of promoting the value that could come from it. Jess, where are people going to try and find more about your fabulous new course? Where are we going to send them?
Maybe to my Instagram, okay. Jess Rufus, which has a really pesky H in there. It's really annoying to spell. R-U-H-F-U-S. Like Rufus the band, but with a weird H in there.
Rufus the band, but with a weird H. I mean, there'll be a link below anyway, so it's fine. What do you think the future of partnerships looks like in the next sort of 10 years? What do you think businesses are going to be spending more time looking at this seriously, given what's happening in the world right now? Or do you think it's still going to be a portion of the marketing mix that they've got?
I think like with any marketing tactic, there is no silver bullet. There's no one thing like just doing Meta isn't going to serve you. Just doing partnerships isn't going to serve you. I think you need a really strong ecosystem, but I think an ecosystem that doesn't have partnerships as part of it is not destined to fail. That seems really dramatic, but that is kind of what I believe.
Me too. Yeah, totally. You know,
so I think it's becoming more and more necessary. Advertising costs are rising. It's getting harder and harder to stand out. As you said, it's more saturated, the market. Everyone's competing for attention, and partnerships are a really amazing fast track to do that. And they're up to 35 times cheaper than digital advertising.
Yep.
And that was a study done in 2017, and ads costs have risen. So I just know partnerships it's are higher. Even more valuable now.
That's it.
And looking at all of my, you know, all of my businesses, the two of my businesses, partnerships made up 25% of my revenue, like directly. Yep. It was a direct revenue. It was a line item on my P&L. And then it was also a really big portion of how we reach new customers as well. Because as I said, different marketing partnerships can achieve different results. So some partnerships are geared towards reaching new people rather than driving revenue. I think it's necessary, especially as ads costs continue to rise and people need to innovate and do things differently. Why not team up and work together?
Yeah. You mentioned before something about number two, and we've done this here too, around referrals and rewarding the referral. So there might be something inside the Australian psyche which is very different to the US and Europe on this. But I'm very happy to pay people for a referral. Very, very happy. And to make it handsome, right? To make it – sounds very masculine. To make it very good for whoever does it. And let me just throw to you the model that we use. I'd love you to tear it apart a bit because it'll be different for every brand.
Sure.
But I think the KISS principle is really important here. When I hear of brands that do sort of a trail commissioning thing and trying to measure and bits, I get why that happens, and I get why it's appealing if you can build a really significant business around that. And I guess the home loan market is one of those ones, right, where they sell you the loan and then they get an enormous amount of money back. I think life insurance is like that as well. It used to be. When it comes to products like number two and the other ones that are more consumer focused, I'd love to learn what your mental model for that is. In my practice where people come and do the partnership lab, it's a $4,500 experience. It's not cheap. But when somebody refers, we pay them, and somebody signs up and pays, we pay them $500 to say thank you for that. And it's a one-off and it's upfront. And it's designed deliberately to drive a behavior because we want people to go, hey, I didn't have $500 before, and if I send you four people, that's $2,000, and that's all fantastic. Now, there's a limit to how many people come into these cohorts, so it's not as though you can continue making money, although I'm sure you probably could. But I think the idea of upfront, really generous, doesn't create a sugar hit, but it gives a really great incentive upfront, and then that behavior is kind of set for a while and then you can move on, as opposed to trying to track and the clicks and the throughs and the links and all the pieces, which for many companies is just too sophisticated. And I still haven't come across a really knock it out of the park technical solution for that to really solve that problem, which I'm still surprised about. But I'm just curious. So from when you think about that from number two's point of view and maybe for other brands you're working with, instead of saying, oh, it's going to be great to work with Spotify, it's going to be great to work with these big brands, make it worth their time and their money to do it. And just get past that whole hand-waving phase. Let's just get to the point where we're actually here to make money. And making money is a good thing. It keeps us all sustainable. Mm. How do you think about that?
I think that really does shift depending on the industry space and the type of business. Because you're right, it's very different with product business versus service space. I'm looking at like iconic duos in that course. And I have a similar model where I pay out, I think it's $150 for a referral to the course, and it's a flat fee. And that is what I prefer, because like you, I haven't been able to find a decent technical solution that allows really to track, yeah, you know, ongoing stuff, which yeah, is fine. And I think that works really well for B2B service-based businesses. I have that like finder's fee structure in place with so many of my trusted network that I send people to always anyway. Mm. When it comes to number two, the partnership we just did with HelloFresh comes to mind, because yep, that is how I modeled out what would be worthwhile,
yes,
in that partnership. So how I look at that is our acquisition cost on average on things like Meta, because that's so much easier to track. Mm-hmm. And so over years of time, I've been able to understand what our average customer acquisition cost would be.
Yep.
And that is how I would apply a value framework to a partnership to understand whether it's worth it or not.
Yep.
So with HelloFresh, that partnership, what it involved was flyer inserts in over 25,000 HelloFresh boxes, mm-hmm, that got sent out. I had a really great incentivized deal on there where it was 2-for-1, and we paid for the flyers.
Yep.
And in return, I did a dedicated email blast out with an offer from HelloFresh to my list. Mm-hmm. We had flyers of theirs in our orders as well, and I created a social media reel and stuff for them.
Yep.
So really, there wasn't a lot of cost to that partnership. It cost me, not that much to print the flyers.
Sure.
You know, it was like 6 cents a flyer, yep, or something. That was the major like direct financial cost. Everything else was currencies other than cash,
yes,
and leveraging those, which I love in a partnership. That's, yep, one of the best things you can do, especially as a small business. But how I was actually determining whether that partnership was a success or not was I just looked at the financial cost of the partnership, mm-hmm, and then divided that by how many new customers we acquired. And simple, it was a cheaper acquisition cost than Meta ads. And so I would do it again in a heartbeat.
And HelloFresh, like many other brands, are looking for these on a repeat basis, right? Like it's not, yeah, as though they have to remain relevant, because it's a tricky market, the home delivery grocery game. But
it is.
Having that there is really interesting.
Well, it's adding value to their customer base too, totally, which is great. It's something, it's like a surprise and delight moment for them.
If somebody was, let's hypothetically run through an idea where there is a brand listening to this right now. Let's say they're a small service brand, and let's call them an agency of some kind, and they're trying to work out how to scale through partnerships, and they might be a marketing agency, for example. How should they be thinking about that? Because the margins in a service business often are much smaller given the human cost involved in doing that. So you often hear of discounting as a strategy to acquire. I'm wondering, how should businesses, from your point of view, service-based ones, how should they be thinking about rewarding referrals back to their business? Because yeah, we could give them that chunk of change to go, thanks for doing that. But at some point, the economics just might not let that happen. Is there a better pro bono way of doing that, an exchange of value, something like you said, currency other than cash? How else can people be thinking about it beyond that one payment?
Yeah, there definitely are a million ways you can do, mm-hmm, you can do them. I'm thinking about way back, I did a partnership with Collabosaurus with Law Squared. So it was a legal firm. Yep. They wanted to get in front of other business owners, so it made sense for us to partner, and they created a bunch of contract templates that our customers could use for like partnership agreements, mm-hmm, and things like that, and joint marketing agreements. It was a co-branded contract, very simple, and they got a bunch of promotion out of us. So that was currencies other than cash, and that was a, yeah, great way to leverage it. I think as a service-based business, I love what you said around the human element, even though, yeah, it does cost a lot more. I think that also can work to your advantage, because so many of these brands, and I see this so much now that I'm in e-commerce, because, yep, I'm on the other side of the, you know, software versus the brands that they're, mm-hmm, wanting to acquire. And so,
yep,
I'm privy to so many software companies in B2B desperately trying to build relationships and acquire, yep, customers within the product business space. And so many of them miss the mark with just human connection. And I think brands like Yotpo, who I've worked, mm-hmm, with a million times, Rad, who heads up their community there, has done such a brilliant job, because he does things like organize founder dinners.
Yes.
Which isn't really that expensive in the scheme of things, and has converted so many customers for him because it's value and, yep, human connection. So I think certainly there's currencies other than cash that you can leverage. There's also creative human connection things that you can, mm, leverage. that aren't just straight B2B plays, like get this email template for this, you know. So I think there's a million ways you can do it, and it depends on your business and depends on your target market. But if you're a marketing agency wanting to target business owners, I'd think about what kinds of business owners are they, and what other tools are they using, what other businesses are they engaging with, are they hiring some graphic designers, in which case maybe a graphic designer partnership would make sense.
We sadly have to bring this to a close because you've got place to be and I have as well. But I have loved this, Jess. So let's just quickly go back. Dynamic Duos, it closes tomorrow.
Yes.
As I think about when we're 6th of May, as we think about publishing. We will link to where you can get access to that here. And all I can say is highly recommended. Like the amount of expertise and muscle you've built in this area over the last 20 years is pretty extraordinary. And the ability for somebody to go, I just need to get started. I'm not really sure where to start. And the really cornerstone base of that, got to get after it. I think it'll be a really great experience for them.
Amazing. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet.
I will talk about collabs all day.
All day. But now you have a good one.
Thanks, you too.